servant bound for glory. O dear Lord, please hear my prayer. O Lord, please hear my prayer. Keep me safe. Servants bound for glory. O dear Lord, please hear my prayer. When my work on earth is done, and you
Happy Sabbath to you. I have a different type of message that I want to share with you here this morning. Some preachers might call this type of sermon a biographical sermon. And I wanted to do this because of this particular month that we are recognizing. The message for this morning is entitled, He Walked Among Kings. He walked among kings. And not too many days ago, if you were to grace the supermarket or a store with your presence, you would have noticed a whole bunch of flowers for a very important time of year to some people, I guess. To others, not so important, doesn't really matter. But we've been inundated by flowers recently, haven't we? When you think of a flower that spells grace, or they put it up too early. They put it up too early. You're supposed to guess, but now you know. When you think about a flower that spells grace and well, delicate beauty, what flower comes to mind? The orchid. The orchid, that's right. It's a highly coveted ornamental plant, of course, delicate, exotic, the graceful orchid. And throughout time, orchid has had symbolic meaning. During the Victorian era, orchid symbolized luxury. And today it kind of takes on something similar, but it also includes rare and delicate beauty. But don't think that because the orchid is delicate, that it is weak. Many orchids are strong. According to the experts, some grow in deserts and wet, swampy grasslands. Others live on coastlines and islands made of limestone coral. Others put up with a little bit of sea salt spray. They endure that. Some grow along rivers and streams, and water may cover them at times, and still they yet survive and still grow. And if you were to ever travel to the Antarctic Circle, which I wouldn't imagine too many would endeavor to do, you'd find some orchids there as well. You know, we mistakenly deem weak what often proves to be strong. Those that we incorrectly deem to be or assume to be inadequate or unimportant often reveal their invaluable worth. Never underestimate the weak, the inferior, or the simple. K. Curiously, and not so much though, God delights to take men and women, to take boys and girls that others might consider dispensable and make them indispensable. Those who might appear to be weak to others and make them strong. As a matter of fact, I just want to look at a couple of Bible verses with you this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 27. Notice the Apostle Paul's way, elegant and graceful way of putting this. In 1 Corinthians 1, verse 27, he says, "But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame those which are mighty." And if you go over to 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 9, we have Paul speaking about himself, and he records these words that Jesus spoke to him when he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." And Paul goes on to say, "Therefore, most gladly will I rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." And then over in Hebrews, writing about those heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, Paul encouragingly reminds us that out of weakness, they were made strong. They were made strong. So this morning, on this day in February, Black History Month, I want to tell you the intriguing story of a man who came into this world disadvantaged, sick and weak, and yet by the grace of Mr. Creator, because that's how he referred to God, Mr. Creator, he became strong, accomplished, and resourceful. This man, born under the ravages and injustices of 19th century slavery, a man by all appearances not destined to greatness, ended up walking among kings. Now, I refer to the orchid this morning because it's a flower. And this morning, for other than the reason related to the season, flowers and plants are related to this fascinating story that I want to share with you here this morning. If we just go back to the mid-1800s, this is where the story began. And it began on a farm in Diamond, just outside of Diamond, Missouri. And Mary, she sat on the doorstep of her front door, a one-room cabin, rocking her baby in her arms as she hummed a simple melody. And it was winter time. The sun, of course, didn't give much heat, but at least it had light, because inside the cabin it was very dark, and there were dark thoughts circulating in her mind. Pretty four-year-old Melissa and a husky Jim, 2 years younger, they played in the dirt at her feet. And then last Sunday, her husband Gills had walked over from the Grant plantation, and during their few hours together, quiet hours together, they were happy. Then yesterday, they brought the word that Gills had fallen off a wagon when they were hauling logs and his life had been snuffed out. You see, Mary had been born on the Grant plantation about 17 or 18 years earlier and didn't know what it was to be free, because her mum and dad didn't know what it meant to be free. The next farm over, next to the Grant plantation, was Moses, owned by Moses. Moses and his wife Susan were repulsed by slavery, but with the death of their child and Susan's irreconcilable grief, Moses took Grant up on his offer to buy young Mary, not to be a slave, but to be free. And when Susan first laid eyes on Mary, her spirits lifted. There was going to be no ma'am or sir in this house. Mary was to call them Aunt Susan and Uncle Moses. She was a part of the family. Susan acted like a doting grandma when Mary's first child, Melissa, was born. And she again was doting when her second child, Jim, was born. And she was also doting when her youngest was born. And when the youngest was only 2 months old, the children caught the whooping cough. Now, Melissa and Jim, they were pretty strong children. They got over it relatively quickly. But the youngest, the latest child to be born, was a very delicate baby. And he would cough and cough until his lips turned blue, and Mary feared that he would die. Those were bad times. The southern states had seceded from the Union. There was war between brother and brother. Moses, his sympathy was with the North because he had hoped that Lincoln and his army would win the war and then free and liberate the slaves. In the meantime, there was these lawless bushwhackers that raided the border country, and they would rob anything from farmlands that weren't strong enough to defend themselves and carry them off, slave and animal, so they could sell them at a hefty price, motivating them to do more of the cruel deed. Sadly, on one particular day, much to Moses' chagrin and every effort he could to prevent it, Mary was kidnapped along with Melissa and their youngest delicate child, and they were sold in Kentucky. Well, Moses quickly hired a neighbor to retrieve them, and the neighbor only succeeded in finding Mary's youngest child abandoned and cold. Now, Aunt Susan, she was a dedicated woman, and she worked really hard to bring and restore this sick boy. Everyone thought he was going to die. He was delicate, and he developed really slowly. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until he was 3 years old before he could actually walk. And as a result of the racking cough, his vocal cords were torn so that he never really developed a deep voice. He always had a high-pitched voice that sometimes squeaked at the most inopportune times. And for years, he had an annoying stammer, and it would get worse every time he got excited. Uncle Moses and Aunt Susan, they raised young George and his brother Jim as their own, and they taught those boys how to read and how to write. The Civil War also ended, and throughout the country it was proclaimed that all slaves were all to be freed. But what did Mary's boys know of slavery? They'd been free to do whatever they wanted in their home. Jim gave up his studies and focused on working the fields with Moses, but George, because he was frail, because he was a sickly child, he couldn't be out on the farm, he couldn't do the work that Jim and Moses were doing. Instead, he kind of worked around the house with Susan, Aunt Susan. And there she taught him to cook and to mend and to embroider and to do laundry and to garden. And she also taught him how to concoct some herbal medicines, medicinal plants. At a young age, George took a keen interest in plants, and he experimented with natural pesticides and fungicides and soil conditioners. And to the neighbors, George became the plant doctor. Someone would have a problem with their rose bushes, and he would go over and he'd fix those rose bushes. Even in their own yard, a tree was dying. It was an apple tree. This is from where they got their applesauce. And George climbed that tree. Aunt Susan told him to come on down. Get down, you can't be up in that tree. And so he called for a saw. Why do you need a saw? Just give me the saw. Sawed off the limb, explained to them that was a deadly fungus that was attacking their tree. And it was on that limb, and he sawed that limb off and it saved the tree. He was a plant doctor because the farmers knew, due to his ability and what he'd learned, he would improve their gardens, their fields, and their orchards. George was a real helper. But he hungered to learn and to study and to learn more. So at the really young age of 11, George left that farm so that he could attend an all-black school in the nearby town of Neosho. Uncle Moses and Aunt Susan knew that that was the last time that they would see George. George was taken in by a childless African-American couple named Andrew and Mariah. And they gave him a roof over his head in exchange for doing chores around the house and around their yard. Mariah was a midwife, and she was a nurse. And she had broad knowledge of medicinal herbs, and she was also a very devout woman, very, very Christian lady. And she passed these things on to young George. You know, when Mariah found George on her property, George had told her that he was lucky that he'd been found by such a nice person as Mariah. But Aunt Mariah told him something that George would never forget. She said, no, George, no, you're not lucky. God is good. God is good to you. God needs your help, and he's looking after you. Don't ever forget that, George. And he never did. Do you believe he's looking after you because he needs you? Do you believe he's looking after you because he wants to use your hands to help others? Well, it was here that Carver's George had a name change, George Carver. And it was also here that George received his first Bible. As a matter of fact, it was his very first book that he received. It was Moriah's old Bible, and before long he could read it for himself. And George had a strange habit. He'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, real early. He'd take his Bible in his hand and he would wander out into the woods, and there he would talk with God. And there he would memorize whole chapters of the Bible, and through the years, his love for the Bible and for God grew deeper. He heard God speaking to him from that holy book, the first book he'd ever owned. George was really a good student. He was an excellent student, as a matter of fact. And before long, he learned everything that he could learn in the Osho at that school by that teacher. But there was one lesson, that George refused to learn. You see, the teacher insisted that there was no way to improve your position in life if you didn't have white skin. And George thought to himself, I don't believe that. God loves the colored roses as much as he loves the white ones. Why shouldn't he love colored people, be they black, brown, yellow, or red, as much as he loves white people? And he said to himself, I'm going to show the world. I'm going to show the world. So George moved to Kansas about 2 years later to try another school. And for the next decade, he moved from one Midwestern town to another, putting himself through school and surviving off all those domestic skills that he learned from his foster mums. He ended up graduating from Minneapolis High School in Kansas in 1880, and then he applied to Highland Presbyterian College in Kansas. He was initially accepted at the all-white college, but then he was sadly and tragically rejected when the administration learned he was black. But this didn't deter George. This didn't deter him. In the late 1880s, Carver befriended the Milhollands. They were a white couple there in Winterset, Iowa, and they encouraged him. They saw potential in George. They encouraged him to continue to pursue higher education. And of course, George loved to study, so that wasn't too hard to persuade him. So despite his former setback, he enrolled at Simpson College. It was a Methodist school that admitted all qualified applicants. Now, George didn't have much money to get him through school, but he was always good with his hands. And he always would pray to Mr. Creator to open doors of opportunity so that he could get education, to be able to help more and more people. And God answered those prayers. And he'll always answer those types of prayers if you and I pray them as well. Lord, open doors of opportunity for me so that I can grow and learn, so that I might help and bless others as well. This was the picture that you just saw up there. He ended up opening a little laundry right there, and he would iron shirts, and he didn't really have too many customers to begin with, but he prayed, and the customers, they came. And the teachers, they saw potential in George, and they encouraged him. He was studying art and piano because he loved to draw, and he was becoming more and more accomplished. He loved music. But one of his professors, Etta Budd, after seeing his interest and his expertise in plants and flowers, encouraged George to apply at the Iowa State Agricultural School, now known as Iowa State University, to study botany. Well, as the story goes, Miss Budd's father was a professor over there at that college, at that school. And when she would write letters back home to her father, she would also be telling him a lot about her young protege, George. And apparently she told him so many good stories and so many good things about George that her father invited George to come and enroll in the school, leave where he was and to come. And George ended up accepting that invitation. And when George arrived at the college, there was no room for anyone, not even him, in the dormitory. And so, as the story goes, the dean of the agricultural program took his desk and all of his belongings out of his office and called for a bed to be put in his office so George could have a room to stay. While here, George won the confidence and trust of a lot of students and also faculty, because George was a happy young man and he was a pleasure to be around. And on one occasion, they pulled their resources together. He didn't know about it. There was an art exhibit in town and he really wanted to go, but there was no way that he would be seen in the clothes that he was wearing. But unbeknown to him, his friends that he had made at school, they had pulled together their resources to buy him his first suit, including a hat and shoes and socks, a tie, and even an overcoat. And they took him there, and on the way there, they told him that he was going to represent the college at the art exhibit in Cedar Rapids. Unbeknownst to him, Miss Budd had sent four of his paintings that he had painted at the school to be entered into the art exhibit. And all four of those paintings won prizes. One of the pictures, a yucca plant, was sent to be exhibited at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. And that painting won honorable mention. It was in 1894 that George Carver became the first African-American to earn a Bachelor of Science degree. And impressed by George's research on fungal infection of soybean plants, his professors asked him to stay for graduate studies, which he did. 2 years later, George Carver earned his Master's of Agricultural degree and immediately received several offers to come and teach at some attractive universities or schools. The most attractive invitation that he got came from Booker T. Washington, whose last name George would later add to his own. Booker T. Washington, of course, was president of Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University in Alabama. And Carver, he was quick to accept the offer where he would work at Tuskegee Institute for the rest of his life. When Carver arrived at Tuskegee, he could hardly contain his gasp of horror because he saw all those dilapidated buildings. He saw the dusty roads and he saw an unattractive grounds. And curiously, there was this big bold sign that said, "Keep off the grass." There wasn't a blade of grass anywhere to stand on. The contrast between here and Iowa State was incredible, but he didn't regret his decision. He went to work with whatever was provided him to get things going, and there wasn't much for him to use at all. George was handy with what he could find around and put it to work. But Carver's early years at Tuskegee Institute wasn't without hiccups. For one, agricultural training was not popular. They called the course farming. And because a lot of the individuals, families in the area, their families and their children were farmers, they didn't think they needed to be taught how to farm because they knew how to do it. And so that's why they sent their kids off to school. And these kids wanted to go to school to escape farming. So George ended up changing the name farming to agriculture. That sounded a little bit more fancy, and he got some students to enroll. Carver also struggled with the demands of the faculty position that he held because he wanted to devote his time to researching for ways to help out poor Southern farmers. Because of King Cotton, he recognized that their crops were getting smaller and smaller and smaller. How could he help them? But he was expected to manage two farms at Tuskegee. He was supposed to teach, ensure that the faculty or the facility toilets and sanitary facilities worked properly. And he was to sit on multiple committees and studies. This frustrated him a lot. But somehow he managed it all. And before long, the school was profiting from their own agricultural program. And he had grass growing around that sign that said, "Keep off the grass." Carver had great success in the laboratory and as well in that community around the school. He taught those poor farmers how they could feed their animals, their livestock, with acorns instead of commercial feed, and also enrich their croplands with what was called swamp muck instead of fertilizers, saving them a ton of money. And his idea of crop rotation proved to be valuable. Because of what he called King Cotton, it was depleting the soil and their crops were getting smaller and smaller, and so was their income. It was becoming smaller and smaller. And so he came up with the idea of crop rotation because he knew that the soil needed all the soil, the nutrients were being depleted from the soil and they were producing these low yields. And he realized that they needed to grow nitrogen healthy plants like peanuts and soybeans and sweet potatoes. And as they took on, and it was slow and it was hard work, they didn't accept his suggestions quickly or too kindly at times. But others who adopted the methods realized after time that those crops would grow and flourish, and even cotton was growing well again. Farmers loved the high yield of cotton. But it's interesting, there was an unintended consequence to growing all those peanuts and sweet potatoes. No one knew what to do with them all. And so, never to let an opportunity go to waste, George Carver set to work to finding alternative uses for these products. So for example, he invented numerous products from sweet potato, including edible products like flour and vinegar and non-food items like stains and dyes and paints and writing ink. But Carver's biggest success came from peanuts. In all, he developed about 300 food and commercial products from peanuts, including milk, Worcester sauce, punches, cooking oils and salad oil, paper, cosmetics, soaps, and wood stains, and the list goes on. And he also experimented with peanut-based medicines, such as antiseptics, laxatives, and goiter medication. We know that George Carver didn't invent peanut butter. That's a misnomer. But he did do a lot of other things with peanuts. And it was in 1921 that George Carver, people knew his expertise, people knew who he was. He was invited to appear before the Ways and Means Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives on behalf of the peanut industry. You see, America was buying cheaply grown peanuts from China, and it was affecting the work down there in the South. People weren't buying as many of the peanuts anymore. And so he went to seek tariff protection because of the low cost of those imported Chinese peanuts. And he was given 10 minutes to present his subject. And you can imagine, George, 10 minutes? I could spend 10 hours talking about peanuts. And as he stood before this august group, he could sense that his audience was indifferent. He could sense that they were actually hostile, and a lot of them were prejudiced. But he wouldn't allow any of that to discourage him. He was there for a purpose. He didn't want to get anything out of it except to try and help out those poor farmers. Somehow he had to break the ice. So silently he prayed, "Mr. Creator, I need your help now. I need your help now." And an idea popped into his head. "Gentlemen," he said, "I have before you some of the products I've made from peanuts. Here are some chocolate-covered peanuts. They're simply delicious, and I will sample some for you." And with that, he popped a couple of those chocolate-covered peanuts into his mouth with evident relish, and that broke the ice. Everyone laughed, they smiled, and he had their attention. Well, when his 10 minutes were up, the chairman of the committee asked the other committee members, should we finish? Should we ask him to stop? They said no. They didn't want him to stop. Carver held their attention for 2 hours, telling them about the 107 products that he discovered from sweet potatoes and 300 from peanuts, and he was just getting started. But finally, he decided to sit down, not because he ran out of material, not because he bored anyone, but because he had a train to catch and he needed to get on it. He earned a standing ovation and also convinced the committee to approve a high protected tariff for that common legume, peanuts, which in turn saved the southern farmers from catastrophe. He then, from then on, became known as the Peanut Man. The Peanut Man. In the last two decades of George Washington Carver's life, he lived as a minor celebrity, but his focus was always on helping people. He traveled to the South promoting racial harmony, and he traveled to India to discuss nutrition in developing nations with Mahatma Gandhi. Until the year of his death, he also released bulletins for the public. They contained some of his research, but most of them were practical bulletins talking about the cultivation for farmers and science for teachers. And he also provided copious recipes for housewives and families. In the mid-1930s, polio ravaged the United States. And Carver became convinced that peanuts could help with the problem. And so what Carver did was offer peanut oil massages to polio patients. And it was reported there were some very positive results because of the work that he did. But nothing, friends, not even fame, could spoil this man's beautiful character. Despite the many tributes given to his great name, including the honorary Doctor of Science degrees from Simpson College in 1928 and the University of Rochester in 1941, George Washington Carver remained the same humble man. He refused to let himself be hurt by unkindness or a lack of any appreciation. One time, a newspaper correspondent, in reporting on an interview with Dr. Carver, referred to him as a toothless old man. Some of his friends were pretty angry at such disrespect given to Dr. Carver. Well, Dr. Carver was reported with simulated indignation. He responded by saying, how could they say that of me? How could they say that if they'd only asked me, I would have shown them that I'm not toothless. I had my whole set, all 32 of them, in my pocket. You know, George Carver didn't forget his old friends, though they might be humble. He went back home to visit Uncle Moses Carver. Aunt Susan had passed away some years before, but the 96-year-old man declared his cup was full when he saw George return. Aunt Mariah was still alive in the Osho, so he went to visit her there too. George Washington Carver numbered many famous men among his friends. The Duke of Windsor, who for a short time ruled England as King Edward VIII, considered him one of the great men of the world. And the Crown Prince of Sweden was happy to call Dr. Carver his friend. Henry Ford and George Carver were kindred spirits. Together they worked to produce synthetics. They made synthetic rubber from goldenrod and another synthetic substance to replace metal when making cars. When George was ill, Henry Ford sent his own personal physician to attend to his friend. You know, there were many honors that were also given to George, but it was two of them, what might have been considered least significant, that gave him the greatest pleasure. The first one, 18 schools named their schools after him, a boy who was determined to get an education because he loved to learn so that he could help others. The other honor, which he really appreciated, was a road marker put up by the Missouri Highway Commission directing travelers to his birthplace. He thought that his childhood friends would be prouder of their town because he had made it a little bit famous. George had been called Carver, a great American. Carver, the plant doctor. Carver, the wizard of Tuskegee. And indeed he was all of these because God used his strong brown hands with those slender, supple fingers to soothe wounded hearts with his music, to massage away pain from cramped muscles or legs crippled from polio, and to unlock secrets stored in such plants as the sweet potato and the peanut. But he was more than that. He was a child of God. He overcame tremendous obstacles and succeeded beyond his wildest boyhood dreams because he was simply willing to give his heart to Jesus, to follow his plan for his life, and to give God all that he could possibly give him. Carver died on January 5, 1943 at Tuskegee Institute. He was buried next to Booker T. Washington. And soon after, the President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed legislation for Carver to receive his own monument, an honor previously only granted to Presidents George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, the George Washington Carver National Monument, which now stands in Diamond, Missouri. I want just for a moment for you to look at your hands. Take a look at those hands of yours. What do you see? Do you see insecurity? Do you see impossibility? Do you see inability? Or do you see potential? Do you see possibility? Do you see promise? Who made your hands? Mr. Creator, that's right. Mr. Creator made your hands. Does he have a plan for your life like he did George Washington Carver? Surely he does. Do you know what that plan is? Do you know what he wants you to do? And if you're not sure, then like George Carver, keep on asking God. Keep doing your best with what lies before you, with what you have in front of you. And always remain humble and always trust in Jesus. Someone here today might be feeling just a little bit weak, a little bit insecure. And sometimes they think that maybe it's not worth just giving it their best at times. People don't appreciate it. People may give you a hard time. Maybe not going anywhere that you want to go in life. And then for you, I would like to encourage you to look at the hands of Jesus. The hands that fashioned and formed you. The hands that were nailed on Calvary's cross for you, so that you might know that what God's plan is for you and that he wants to use your hands to bless others. And also remember Remember the words of Hebrews chapter 11, verse 34. Out of weakness, they were made strong. Let God make you strong as you live for Him and as you give your best for Him. What do you say today?
Give of your best to the master. Give of the strength of your youth. Throw your soul's fresh glory idol into the battle for truth. Jesus has set the example. Dauntless was He, young and brave.
Father in heaven, thank you for the story of George Washington Carver. Thank you that at a young age, he invited you into his life. And from that day forward, he determined to give him your best, to give you his life, and to leave a legacy that is worthy of imitating. Lord, help us not to feel insecure or insufficient. May we remember that we are valuable in the eyes of God twice over. First, He created us, and then You made us and into Your image by dying on Calvary's cross. And that work continues today as we surrender our hearts and lives to You. Lord, use us. We give You the best that we can. And when we know that our best is not good enough, may we know that Jesus' best is. Lord, thank You for Your great love for us. And because of Your great love for us, we want to give You the best that we can offer You to bless and benefit those around us, to be a blessing and to not be a curse. May we be pleasant to be around, a joy, And may others see a little bit of Jesus in us. Help us, Lord, to be resourceful, to be compassionate and kind, and to always be thinking of what more we can do for you, because you've done so much for us. Keep us and bless us to this end, I pray. And again, thank you for the privilege to serve you and to give you our best. In Christ's name, I pray these things. Amen.